part, the basic objective is to go through the story of the Yetzias Mitzrayim, the secret of Mitzrayim, by darshaning the Pesukim, the Limud. Well, the section that the Haggadah relates to is in Kiselo, Argus and Kiselo. Now, in this, it recounts the story of how the Jews went down to Mitzrayim and so forth. This is Vayei Mitzrayim on us off the Adibo. They were forced into going into Mitzrayim because of the Dvar Hashem. Vayagar Sham, and they dwelled there, they sojourned there. Malamed Shloyard Yaakov Avinu Lishtakev Mitzrayim Ela Logar Sham. The text teaches that Yaakov Avinu did not go down to dwell permanently in Mitzrayim, but just to sojourn there. Now, what's the proof of that? Shenemar, as it says, Vayomer el Paro, they said to Paro, that's a reference to the to the brothers. They said to Paro, Logar Ba'aretz Banu, we come to sojourn in the land. Kiyein mir el atzon asher la vadecha, because there's no food for the sheep that are of your servants. Because the famine is very powerful in the land of Canaan. The Yata, now Yishman Avadecha Be'eretz Goshen. Now let your servants dwell in the land of Goshen. Now I saw this the Agada of the Rav. Well, it's not his own, it's put together by his grandson. So he has a very good kasha. And you could ask that kasha when you learn the parsha itself. It's really not that much a Haggadah question, it's a Chumash question. But it's a very good question, and it's a very interesting idea. So let's just pause for a minute. Yeshu, in the Pasuk, Yeshu na, Be'eretz Goshen, it simply means where we're going to settle. Because we have to have a place. In other words, it's not going to be that short a time that we don't need a place. It sort of qualifies the Logar Sham. I mean, you know, you can go on a tour of a place. If they were coming there for 2 weeks or a month, I don't think they would say Yeshu na, because that's not a yeshiva. So yeshiva means we have to settle there. Alright? But what's the basic das? Is the basic das to make this our residence? This is our new country. We're becoming Egyptians. Right? Or is the intention to stay here temporarily because of a certain situation, and when that situation is no longer, changes, then we'll leave. So the Haggadah is saying that they did not come lehishtakea for the triumph, el logar sham, and uses this pasuk. But there's something that's very strange about the pasuk itself. Get up to the end of Nem Vav. Yosef had arranged for them to go to Paro. Yosef said to his brothers, the half of his father, Ela v'yagid l'paro, I'll go up and I'm going to tell Paro, v'omrei lov, and I'll say to him, Achai u'beis avi, asher b'yaretz Kanaan bo eloi. My brothers in the house of my fathers that are in the land of Kanaan have come to me. Anoshim roi tzon, and the men are shepherds, kianche mikna hayu, the people who own animals, flocks, tetanam uvakaram, v'cholash alam eviyu, and they come with all their flocks. Okay, you have to understand the significance of Pasuk Lamed Beis. Why is that so important, that they're really tzon and that they brought their flocks with them? Then again, this is a very important point. And it's like this, Vahayati Yikro Lachem Paro, and Paro calls for you, the Amar Mama Seichem. So, what does that mean? Vahayati Yikro Lachem Paro. Is it a planned thing? Are they going to meet with Paro or not? seem that he's not making an appointment for them to meet with Pharaoh, but he understood, he knew the nature of Pharaoh, and that Pharaoh would be very interested to meet Yosef's brother. He would be very interested, because he was obviously very impressed with Yosef, and now his family's coming down. Yosef was pretty certain that he would want to meet with them, so therefore he instructed the brothers what to say to him. Now, v'amartem, and you shall say, anshei mikneh, hayo v'dechah. Now, why is he telling them all this? The brothers are highly intelligent people, and they certainly know what they do, right? V'amartem, anshei mikneh, hayo v'dechah. And you shall say that we own cattle, sheep. What is a good question? Is the Hanashim Relaytan a continuation of the Omre Elov, or is it a separate idea? Is it in parentheses? In other words, who is saying Hanashim? Is that Yosef, or is that as Rashi sometimes says, Ruach HaKodesh is saying that? In other words, that's the Torah speaking. We read the pasuk in isolation, but Rashi points out what? Va'od Omer Lo, Hanashim Relaytan. Rashi says that this is a continuation. And the Sif Sefer Chum says, what's Rashi mean over here? What's Haloma Delo Tefarish Ki Nohanoshim Roitzon Hu Divrei HaKosef? That's not Divrei HaKosef, that's a continuation of the speech of Yosef. So this leads us to another question. It's repetitive. If Yosef is going to give Pharaoh the information, it seems at this point that Roitzon is extremely important. Obviously, the Torah is making a very big point out of this. It's very important to Yosef, and Yosef himself is going to tell it to Pharaoh. Okay, which in and of itself would be all right. I mean, it's a piece of information. I don't see why it's that important. But then, in addition, he's going to tell the brothers to tell him that. Why does he have to tell the brothers to tell him that when he himself has told them that? And if he didn't tell the brothers, wouldn't the brothers would know that I would have no reason to lie? Then he says, "Voyot yukalacham Pharaoh." And it'll be when Pharaoh will call for you, va'omar, and he'll say, Mama Sechem, what's your job? What do you do? Then he says, Amarta Manche Mikne, how you have a decha, minurenu viadata. Anche Mikne, your servants have been, men who own cattle. Where are you until now? And this pasuk says darshani. This pasuk says analyze me. You tell me how you'd analyze the pasuk. Gamma nachnu, gamma vosenu. Bafur teshu veres Goshen, in order that you shall dwell in the land of Goshen. Kisav as Mitzrayim kol roei tzom, because it is the abomination of all of Egypt, shepherds roei tzom, because they worshipped the sheep. Okay, let's analyze Lama Dala now. Aside from the question we raised, why is it important Anshe Mikna Hayu Avadecha Minureinu Viadaka? Yeah, I mean, why is that so important? What's the difference what you did as a youth? This is what you did as an adult. This is the key. Also, Gama Nachnu Gama Voseinu. What difference? That certainly doesn't make any difference. What your fathers did is not relevant at all. I'm really not. I mean, curiosity is one thing. Clearly, this is for practical matters. In practical discourse, you're going for an interview, and you have a resume. Alright, so you put down your own background. We're only interested in maybe basically what you're doing now, but we're certainly not interested in what your father did. I don't think that's a valid question in an interview. Now, Vayeva Yosef, and Yosef the king, Vayagi the pharaoh. He told Pharaoh, "Vayom Rabbi v'Achai v'Tzonam u'Bakar m'Chol Shalahem Bo me'Eretz Kanaan v'Hinam v'Eretz Goshen." All right. So he tells Pharaoh that his father and his brothers and their sheep and cattle and everything that belongs to them has come from the land of Canaan, and they are in the land of Goshen. Then it says, "U'Mikse Echav Lokach Hamisha Nashim." And he chose some of his brothers, five of them. Rashi says he chose Apchusim Shebehem, the Gvura, the weaker ones amongst them. Sheinir and Giborim, the ones that didn't appear like mighty ones. Shem Yerosam Yiborim, because if he would have shown Paro the Yiborim, Yasa Osam Anche Mochamto, he would have put them in, you know, in his army, in charge, commanding position. Alright? Alright, so he took a few. By Yatsige Mosnei Paro. And placed them before Paro. And by Yom Paro La'alachov, Paro said to his brothers, Ma'amasechem. By Yom El Paro Roitzon Avodecha, we're Roitzon. So apparently they do, that might answer your question, Moshe, because they do say Roitzon. So apparently that was included, you know, in Anche Mitzvah Roitzon. Gama Nachma Gama Loseinu. Us and our fathers. But then they say something new. I don't know if Yosef instructed them to say this. By Yom Ro Paro Logar Ba'aretz Bana, we've come here to dwell in the land. Yei Mir Latzon Asher Lev Adecha. Because there's no food, no fodder for the sheep of your servants. Yichavei Darav Ba'aretz Kanaan. Because the famine is very strong in the land of Canaan. And now let your servants dwell in the land of Goshen. What is difficult about that? There's a glaring difficulty in this portion. Whether Mira is to be translated as the food or the pasture, the grazing land, wouldn't make that much difference, it seems, in terms of the, because the question is very fundamental. The question of who cares why you're coming, I think, is relevant, because I want to know what your intentions are. You know, in what capacity are you coming here? So I have to know, I mean, do you plan to make this your country? You're an immigrant. Is it a temporary situation because there's a war? Do you plan to make this your country? So I have to know what brings you here. Why are you here? That is important, I would say. The question is this the real, what's the real reason that they came here?
Because they needed food.
Because they were starving.
Right.
Because the famine would affect them. Isn't that the real reason? That's the basic reason why they're there. Why? Of course, you want to sustain your animals as well. But the animals are only important because they're part of your existence. But if you're going to starve in a famine, then what good is your animals? I mean, if they all had some type of a disease and they were going to die within a few months, they would come down to Mitzrayim because of the, and let's say that the food that they needed they could get back home, but the food the animals needed could only be gotten in Mitzrayim. They're not going to come down there for the animals. The basic reason they're coming down is because of the famine and because they were going to starve, it would seem.
Yeah.
That's the case. If that is the case, so why don't they tell Paro the basic reason? The basic reason that they're coming down is not because of Eid Mir Latzon. The basic reason is there's no food for us because of the famine. Yet they chose to say something else. Kelly is making a good point. Mama Seichan. You see, Paro is very concerned with that. This rings true because even this Manazah, every country is always concerned about immigrants, and one of the main concerns is how it's going to affect our economy. We don't want competition, right? As soon as there's this, that was a big problem during the, you know, the Holocaust years and so forth. Immigration, they're very, very strict, keeping everybody out, keeping the Jews out. And one of the reasons was always the economics. Either there'll be an economic burden or there'll be competition, you know, with various unions. Each group doesn't want any competitors coming in. Alright, so Mama Sechem, the fact that Paro would ask that question makes sense. It makes sense today. You want to know what the economic impact is going to be. So the answer is good, you know, because they're not concerned. The Mithraim, what was the basis of their economy? It was agriculture. It was an agricultural society, as you see. Everything depended upon the Nile and so forth. And quite the contrary. They weren't cattle, herds. They didn't raise herds and so forth, herdsmen. You tell them you're Asher Nikna and all of that, but to go so far as to say that it's necessary to even mention that we only came down for our animals because we to prove that we're not a threat to you, I think it's going too far. I think it requires a different explanation. Get all the facts. And take a look at the actual reason why Yosef, when Yosef first revealed himself to the brothers in Perek Mem Hei, so he says, after he finishes trying to placate them, Maru, that's what it says, Maru v'yalu elavi, hurry and go up to my father and tell him, thus said your son Yosef, Shemani Elohim Rodan al Mechal Mitzrayim v'doi lai al tamos. He urges him to come down as quickly as possible. We have Shafta v'yaret Goshen, and you'll draw on the land of Goshen. That's interesting, because he's telling him this even before he's made the arrangements. He's telling Yaakov that he will dwell in the land of Goshen even before he's already secured permission from Paro. Oh, interesting. Vayizakar ve'lai, and you'll be close to me. I'll be able to remain, in contact with you, because Yosef was a political leader. But I'll be close to you. Hatu v'necho v'nei v'necho, you and your children and grandchildren, v'tzoncho v'charcho v'chosho, and everything, all your possessions, all your flocks. Now, you know the reason. What's the reason for all this? Why do this? Why should the family have rooted itself? It's because Yosef is in the time. The chilkal to Yosef Hashem, and I'll feed you, I'll sustain you, sustenance. Machalkel, chayim mechesed, that's to sustain. He owes chameshan and rav, because there's 5 more years of famine. Tenti varish ata oveisra v'chol ha-shalach, lest you all become impoverished. That's the main reason. The main reason is, it would seem, is to sustain them. And it would seem that the basic reason why did they come down? They didn't come down just to visit Yosef, they came down because of the famine.
Same
reason why they came the first time was to acquire food, to keep themselves alive. Right? That's the basic reason. Yet they're telling Paro something different. It seems that they're putting the cart before the horse. The sheep have become the essence, and they fade into the background somewhere. Paro is not a stupid person. Back now to the Parsha. Another question that the Rav raises. By Yered Mitzrayim, Onos al Piyadibur. What does that mean, Onos al Piyadibur? Yered Mitzrayim, they went down to Mitzrayim, they were Onos. In other words, they did not go down voluntarily. That's the point over here. That they didn't go down voluntarily. But they were Onos. Onos is someone who was coerced by the Dibur, by the Word of God. Let me quote to you. Anasofia Dibur, Yesh Ayan, Dalo Yaakov Vim Yard Mitzrayim, Midas Asma. This is Yaakov Avinu. He refers to Yaakov. Yaakov went down to Mitzrayim voluntarily. Kedichsiv, as it says, by Yom Yisrael, Rav, Od Yosef to Michoy. It's a great thing. My son Yosef is still alive. Let me go and see him before I die. So when they came back with the reports, and first he didn't believe them, then he saw the Agalos, and then he believed them, and then he said, let me go down and see him. So it wasn't on a faulty idea, but it was voluntary. That's his question. He refers to the Shivlei Haleket and the Avudraham. And the Seder Haggadah. Here was the whole reconciliation in Mem Hei. You see clearly that Yosef is trying to, I don't want to say appease them, but to make them feel better. That the whole purpose of this, when he says that this is really part of the divine plan, was Kiva Michya, to save for salvation. Right? That we'd all be dead. Well, if I was not in this position, then we all would have died in the famine. So therefore they shouldn't feel dead, that everything was part of God's plan.
Yeah, that's in Pasuk Hey. Viata al peyatzu al viayicha bilechem kimechartem oti heina kilamitzvah shvachani al tzimul tzeichem tizesh nasayim harav bekerav aret yod chameshonim hasherin charish v'katzir vayish lacheni al kimuch nechem losim lachem she'eris b'aret ulahachios lachem nefleita gedola. So it's all to save you, salvation. That's the real reason, to save your life. Then, you know, after they come back and they speak Yaza, so as we just quoted, Vayom Yisrael, Rav, Al Yosef Tinichai, El Kavi Arenu, the Taramola. Then it says, Vayisa Yisrael, Chalash Alal, Vayyavo Be'er Shava, Vayizbach Zvachim Lelekei Aviv Yisrael. So then he went to Be'er Shava, and he brought sacrifice. Vayom Relakim Yisrael, Mar Halayla, and God said to Yaakov, in a vision of the night, Vayom Yaakov Yaakov, Vayom Rinoni, Vayom Anokhi Akev Akev, Yicha Al Tira Me'adav Yisrael. Do not be afraid, Al Tira Me'adav Yisrael, do not be afraid to go down to Yisrael, to a Gego to Asim Hashem, because I'll make you into a great nation there. Anokhi Ere Dimcha Yisrael, I will go down to you, with you to Mitzrayim. The Anokhi Alpha Gamalol, and I will bring you up from there. The Yosef Yoshis Yodo Alaynecha, and Yosef will place his hand on your eyes. Then it says, Ayokhi Yachim Zer Shava, and they traveled up there. Now this is very difficult. Why does God appear to him and tell him not to be afraid? He was going down there voluntarily. That's his own idea. Rav, O Yosef, Nisai, Eilfra, V'yarenu, V'teramolam. Then all of a sudden God appears to him and tells him not to be afraid. Where is there any indication that he was afraid? And what was he afraid of? Al-Pi'a Dibra is Dibra Hashem. But he said, Al-Tira Meredam Yisrael. He gives a very good answer. Point. To resolve the contradiction. The Eilfra, V'yarenu, V'teramolam. All Yaakov was saying is, all he wants to do voluntarily was to just go and visit him. He wanted to see him again. That's all. He didn't come back.
Why not?
But now he didn't want to stay in this time. Daddy needed that he was afraid of. And what was he afraid of? He was afraid of that they would become assimilated into the culture of this time. That's what he was afraid of. But Yosef planned it out very, very carefully. Yes, this was the main concern. The main concern was that he wasn't concerned that Paro wouldn't want them in the country. Paro would want them in the country. You see, Paro had a very positive reaction. I mean, he had great respect for Yosef, and certainly he would want the family. They're very capable people, right? And in terms of the economy, in terms of building the country, that's why Yosef had to pick out the weaker of the brothers, because he didn't want to show him all the brothers. Yeah, but what would he want to do? What would he seek to do? To assimilate them into the culture of the country. That's what you want them. You want them to be part of your country. You don't want them to be distinct. So therefore, you want them to give up their own customs, their own religion, and to assimilate, to adopt to become Egyptians. To become Egyptians. That's the concern. That was the concern of Yosef. Yosef, of course, didn't want that to happen. He knew that as long as they were in Canaan, they had their own situation, separate. They were separate, they had their own situation, and they were insulated, protected. Now, what was the solution? The solution was to keep them separate. Separate in two ways, to have their own place, okay? But also, there's something else. This is what the Rav emphasizes, and that is that the main occupation of Mitzrayim was farming, and the Paro would want to integrate them somehow into the area of farming, to give up their old occupation. It's no longer relevant over here. So basically, coming to Mitzrayim, we're not farmers. They don't raise sheep. You know, our whole economy revolves around agriculture. So that's a strong feeling. He's going to want to impose that upon them. But Yosef knew that if they could not survive separately, they couldn't survive philosophically if they were to become farmers. Because there's been this. See, there's a tremendous identification of workers. Once you are part of the Egyptians, once you're integrated with them in the economics, is a very powerful thing. That would be a tremendous breach. Then, see, there's a certain mentality, all workers in different fields, especially like farmers. You know, farmers get together from different parts of the country, there's a certain identification. It's much more difficult to maintain that separatism. So therefore, you see the tremendous emphasis. Goshen, he wanted them to be in Goshen, which is physically apart, but also that they will remain distinct because they will be engaged in an occupation which is completely different and even alien, but mainly different. That's why there's so much emphasis on Va'anoshim Ro'ei Tzom. Yosef said it to Paro, Va'anoshim Ro'ei Tzom. He tells us in advance to Paro. But you see, it's very important that the brothers repeat it. Because Yosef hasn't seen the brothers in a long time. So Yosef is only talking about what the situation was when he was there, but it's been many years since he's seen them. So they themselves have to make the point. Now when they come to before Paro, that's why the whole emphasis is that it's not just what we do. Because a person can change his occupation. But this is something which is very sacred to us. We've done it since we're children, we've been raised, this is our fathers, our forefathers have done this. In other words, this is the fact that we're Ro'ei Tzom is not just an accidental thing, but that's part of our whole culture to be Ro'ei Tzom. That's why when they came down in front of him, they said, That the implication being that as far as ourselves is concerned, we would have stayed behind. We would have gotten by on whatever. We would have lived in a minimalistic type of state. We came only to get it. Because it's own, that's our whole purpose, our whole occupation, and that's something we have to maintain. That's why in Pasuk Gimel, they say, when he says, Vayomer Paro Ro'ei Tzom Avedecha Gam Anachnu Gam Aloseinu. I mean, this is a family thing, it's a tradition, it's a fair fun. And that's why we came down. The implication being, of course, I don't think they're going to say that we would die, but as far as ourselves are concerned, we would have gotten by in an impoverished state, minimal. But we could never sustain our sheep. So we came here precisely for the purpose of sustaining the sheep. Ah, so if that's the case, Paro's not going to try and get them to give that up and become farmers. It doesn't make any sense. That was a very powerful argument. And that's why the Ata Yeshu Navadecha Bi'er is Goshen. You see? And Paro agrees. All of this was intended for two things. To secure Eretz Goshen, right? And also to preclude Paro from trying to assimilate them by introducing them to agriculture. So that was the whole concern. The whole concern was that going down into Mitzrayim, that was Yaakov's fear. Yaakov wanted to go down and visit with Yosef. He wanted to see him. Yeah, but Yaakov was very leery. He was very concerned about any type of a dwelling, about the establishment of a dwelling, because once you're dwelling in the land, you're going to become assimilated. That's why God reassured him. I'll fear my devil's God. That's the second part. That's why it says, Onos al pi adibur. That if it wasn't for the Dibur, then he wouldn't have agreed to settle there. Yeah. The Dibur. That was the Dvar Hashem. That was the point that I was making, that most people don't think like Yaakov. They're only concerned with the immediate physical, the immediate need. And anyone in that situation can see the land is falling apart, so that people will get up and they'll leave their land. Yaakov was looking at it from a different dimension. Not from the immediate physical, but from the long-term spiritual. That's why he was very concerned. And that's why he needed the assurance of God that in terms of the long-term spiritual, it will work out. I know if he Alpha Gabala. So to continue the idea that we were discussing yesterday, in the Haggadah, we recount the event that took place through, you know, an explanation of the Pesukim that pertains to each of the times. So it says, Vayeri Mitzrayimah, and he went down to Egypt, and that's a reference to Yaakov, Onos al Pi HaDibur, which means that he was coerced by the word. That is to say, he didn't go down voluntarily. Alright? Now, the Rav in his Haggadah asked a question on this. Take a look at the Pesukim. The question that the Rav asked is, if you go back to the Parsha of Bereishis, when Yosef reveals himself to the brothers, and then he tells them that they should all come down, so they have to come down before the famine will be for another 5 years. Alright, then they come back to Yaakov, and they tell Yaakov about that they discovered Yosef and he's the ruler, and of course Yaakov at first refuses to believe them, but then he sees the wagon, and Chazal say it's an indication he had communicated to the brothers of the Torah that he had left him with, so he was convinced he was still alive. Then he says, Rav, Ayomi Yisrael, Rav, it's a great thing. O Yosef Bini Chai, my son Yosef is still alive. Elcha v'yarenu v'tam amos. And that's an interesting expression, by the way. What does that indicate? I will go and I will see him before I die. What does it mean before I die? Of course, what does it mean? Obviously he's going to see him before he dies. There's an implication over there. I mean, people talk that way, but what do you mean, I'll go and I'll see him before I die? As opposed to what? Obviously, if you go and see him, you're alive. Right? Let's go now. Quickly. Well, he wasn't young at the time. He had 17 more years to go, but he was an older man. I mean, nobody knows exactly when they're going to die. He was in that time of life where he was in that period of life when that statement would make sense. But it indicates also as well, you're right, what I'd be saying is true, that I can't delay it, but I think there's another point to it. Yeah, I'm wrong, but I would say also the implication is that he doesn't intend to stay there. Let me go and see him before I die. In other words, you say, you know, like, you want to visit him. It's a visit that you put off, you know, you may have some relatives in a different part of the world, you may have family in Australia or wherever, or Israel, whatever, and you know, you're too busy, and then you're older, and you say, now is the time, let me go and see them before I die. The point is, you just want El Chavereno, he just wants to go and see him. There's no mention over here about any type of settlement in Egypt. He just wants to go and pay him a visit, which makes sense. The answer is, as Avi said, in other words, no, that's no water. As Derech Eretz, shouldn't it be that the son should go to him? But, you see, Yosef, that was not Yosef. Yosef had a plan. Yosef had thought this out very carefully. Obviously, Yosef had more time to think about this than anybody else. But from the time the brothers came down, he was already thinking about the future, what would happen. So clearly it was Yosef's plan for all of them to come down. That's the way it had to be. Because he knew that there'd be 5 years of famine. And the only way that he could sustain them would be if they came down. So therefore it didn't make any sense. It didn't make any sense. They were going to have to come down. Aside from the fact that it would be problematical for him to leave due to this position. We know that. Therefore, it wasn't a breach of Derech Eretz. It wasn't a breach of Derech Eretz. It's a good question. It was a breach of Derech Eretz. Why should he force his father, who's an old man, to embark on such a journey? He should go to him. The answer is because it wasn't that he was having his father come to him. It was that the family was moving down to Egypt for many reasons. So therefore, there was no breach of Derech Eretz. Okay. But then it says, Vayisa Yisrael, V'chol HaShalom, And Yaakov traveled with everything that he had. Vayavu Be'er Sheva. And they came to Be'er Sheva. Vayizrach Zachem, Elokei Arav Yitzchak. And he brought sacrifices to the God of his father Yitzchak. Vayom Elokim Yisrael, V'maros HaLayla. And God said to Yaakov in a vision of the night, Vayomer Yaakov Yaakov. And he said, Yaakov, Yaakov, Vayom Hineni, and he said, here I am. Vayomer, and he said, Anochi Akeel, Elokei Avicha, I am the God of your father. Al Kirimer Damitraina. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt. Because I'll make you into a great nation there. Anochi Ered Damitraina. I will go with you into Egypt. And I will bring you up from there. The Yosef Yoshis Yodo Ale Nepa. And Yosef will place his hand on your eyes. He was speaking to himself. It's a little bit, it doesn't make sense. Because God is coming in a vision to reassure him and telling him not to be afraid. Where do we see that Yaakov is afraid? There's no indication that Yaakov is afraid, but he wanted to do it. He said he was very happy when his spirit revived. After he saw the wagon. When he saw the wagon, his spirit was revived. Right? His spirit was revived. And then he said, it's a wonderful thing. Let me go and see him before I die. So he's going voluntarily. So where is there any indication that he has to be coaxed? He's afraid. Moreover, the promise is a bit difficult too. There's something a little strange. You need to be careful. God is saying that he'll go down there with him. And what? And he'll bring him up from there too. Well, where do you find that? I mean, Yaakov was removed from Egypt, but he was dead. He never was taken out. His bones. Well, no, that was Yosef's bones were removed. Yosef's bones were removed. But Yaakov was, was buried. He died in the Mitzrayim, and as you know, Yosef had to get permission from Paro and so forth, and the family. You know, it's a big leviathan. Many ministers, dignitaries from Egypt, the company, the body. Is that what it's referring to? That's the promise that he wouldn't be buried over there, and he'd be buried in. That was the whole thing he was afraid of. Don't be afraid to go down there because you won't be buried in the Arz Machpelah.
That's why you know it's not
easy. Let me just state the question and let's see whether this will answer it. In general, I think the question can be raised, why did the Jews have to remain in the time at this point in time? I mean, according to their own understanding of the situation. Yosef's idea was that the family had to come down. Right? I think that makes sense because he had to sustain them. There was 5 more years of famine, and in order to sustain them, they had to be in the triumph, apparently. But why? Whose idea was it that the Jews should take up permanent residence in the triumph? Why did the Jews have to take up permanent residence in the triumph? The whole problem that faced them was 5 years of famine. Now, if that couldn't be dealt with by them staying in Canaan and him shipping food, if that wasn't feasible for some reason or another, because the famine got worse, as we see. So it could be that they couldn't ship food to outsiders. At a certain point, it might be difficult, and only if you were living there. Let's assume that. But why weren't there any plans made that after the 5 years they would return? Why it seems that this is a different kind of a plan. The plan was to uproot. This is a very serious plan. The plan was to uproot their residence from Canaan. And clearly they were supposed to be living in Canaan from the time of Avram. When Avram came down to, when God told him to go El Arat Shareka, when he settled in Canaan, so that's where he was supposed to be, and they only left. Avram had to leave because of the famine, but he rode Barat, so he went down to Mitzrayim. Yeah, but he went temporarily, as soon as he was able, he was happy to get out of there. But as soon as he was able to, he returned. And Yitzhak never even left the land. And Yaakov left only because of circumstantial. He had to escape from Esau. And then when he was able to, he returned. But that was their place. And Yaakov, Vayeshev Yaakov, Eretz Megurei Aviv, then Yaakov took up residence in the land of his fathers, in Eretz Canaan. So, whose decision was it that we should now have a new place? Because they settled, it would seem. Well, the Haggadah is dealing with this. It's saying, Shalayar Yaakov Lishtakei Hashem. He didn't go down there, to settle there in a permanent kind of a way. El Logosham, just to live there temporarily. Now it's telling us, but that's a question. Whose decision was it? Who made the decision? Why? Why was the decision made in the first place? Did they know? I mean, are we going to say that, well, they knew that the God had promised Avram, and this was the time of the Nevuah, that they would be, enslaved in a land which was not theirs, and so on and so forth. I mean, Yosef knew that, and he knew that this was the situation. That would be difficult to say. In other words, you have to account for that. I don't think this was any individual had the right to make that decision. So how did it come about? Why didn't Yosef make provisions that they would come down after the 5 years to work it out, to go back? In Mira, it appears, the Yaakov Avino, that Yaakov's Kavanoso Hoysel Eredes L'Mitzrayim, that his intention was to go down to Egypt, Liros is Yosef, to see Yosef. Umiyad Lachsol Eretz Yisrael, and to return immediately to Eretz Yisrael. Ach kishayarad l'Be'er Sheva, but when he went down to Be'er Sheva, Amalo HaKadosh Baruch Hu, sheyishar sham. God said that he should remain there, v'lo yachzor, and not to return. In other words, it would seem that he's deducing, although it's not stated openly, but that would explain, what do you mean, al-tira? These words are out of context. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt. What do you mean? Yaakov is going down voluntarily. He wants to see him. So you must assume that there was another part, that there's another part of the Nevuah that's not being recorded, and that is that God is telling him to go down there permanently. But then Yaakov would be afraid of that. Because how can we sustain ourselves? How can we maintain our identity if we're going to be in the triumph? The base that they had established for themselves was in Canaan. There they had the basis for existence. Alright, so what he's saying makes sense. Well, Horace, even in Goshen, they're going to now they have to establish the basis for maintaining not just physical, but their spiritual identity. Yeah. But why would you want to do that in the first place? Why not come back? So that's what he's saying. Anos al pi adibur, that he went down there coerced by the command of God. This was the command of God to remain there, and that's why it makes sense that I'll go down with you. Means that the God will be with them in the triumph. They'll retain their identity. Vanochi al kagamolo, and I'll bring you out of there. You see, that makes sense. He's revealing now. He's revealing to Yaakov that this is part of my plan. That this is not just a personal matter between you and Yosef, but this is all a part of my plan, that the Jewish people should now dwell. That is the next phase in the development of Klal Yisrael, that they should take up permanent or temporary, in other words. Of course, it's temporary, but it's not as temporary as Yaakov, not just a visit. That's their new place of dwelling. And I will take you out of there, Kila Gargadah. That this is the situation in which you're going to be transformed into a great nation. So that's Anas al Pi Adibra. That was not the idea of Yaakov. Yaakov did not uproot himself in Canaan and decide to make a new settlement. That would answer the question of why. He's not saying that over here, but I mean, I'm trying to make that connection. That would answer the question as to why they remained in Egypt. Why didn't they leave Egypt? Why didn't they come back? According to, if this reading is correct, if my reading of what he's saying over here is correct, it would be that whole part of the Dibur. That was the Dibur, that they should go down there. It's more than just a matter of getting food, but they should stay there.
That's the will of God. And that's why I said, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid, because that's my plan. And I'm going to, this is going to be the situation in which you're going to develop into a great nation. The answer that Rashi has given will explain the obvious. Well, the essence of the experience in the Mitzrayim has to be displayed. And I think that's contained. I think it's contained in the Chazal. The Chazal said that God also declares to other people, and each group asks, you know, right. Just, you know, and whenever they heard that there was a prohibition, you know, they went against their instinctual nature, so they rejected it. Because most people are living in the world of an instinct. And the natural imagination of a person is that the gateway to happiness is the satisfaction of his instinct. It's the only world that he recognizes. So to tell this person that, a fellow businessman, that the thing he's pursuing, if he were to achieve it, would not really make him happy. And therefore he should change around his entire way of life, and he should just work a couple hours a day, and the rest of the time he should spend the money. So the person will reject it. It's only when a person is in a situation when he's lost all of his hopes, like this way, you see it happens to many people when they're impoverished, when they experience great calamities, interestingly enough, suddenly the mind starts to work. Then the mind, and they start thinking about life. As long as a person is able to go on with his daily routine, the chase, he's part of the chase, and you know, keeping up with the Joneses and so forth, and he's working towards his next car and house, whatever, he's not going to stop and think. Because he's caught up in the fantasy. It's impossible to break it. But when he experiences some type of a calamity, then he begins to ponder, what's the meaning of life? He has to, a person can't just live in a vacuum. That's when the mind starts working. And a lot of people in prison even, that's when they start to first question. So Chazal say, by the way, that you should be careful about the aniyim. Because may aniyei Yisrael yotisor, that's a classical idea from the Talmud, that from the poor, who tend from what strata of society do the great scholars and Talmud Chachamim come from? From the aniyim. By that, it doesn't indicate a high level, but it's psychological reality that when a people is persecuted and threatened, it enhances the bonds of identification, removes all the enmity. Well, you see that even today, you know, whenever Israel's threatened, you remember the days, I keep mentioning it, you fellows didn't experience it, but the days before, during, and after the Six-Day War, if you remember the feeling of unity, it was an amazing kind of a thing. You fellows have not experienced the time of the Yom Kippur War also, but I remember that during the Six-Day War, there was a tremendous feeling of unity amongst all the Jews. Yeah, everybody thought at that time they were on the brink of destruction, and then there was an amazing kind of a thing. Then it's like a tremendous miracle, the way it came about in 6 days.
Like
the danger created a sense of unity and identification that, I mean, I've never seen in my own lifetime. It was an amazing kind of thing. All the shuls filled up, you know, meetings, rallies, and
before and
during, before it began. Well, before there was this tremendous fear. We really thought we were getting wiped out. It was like, you have to remember that it was much closer to the Holocaust, and you have to understand also that you grew up with the idea of Israel being this mighty power and nothing to be afraid of. And you know, that was not the case at that time. Israel was considered to be weak, just barely able to survive, and surrounded by three nations, and Nasser had filled up the Sinai. They were preparing for mass graves in Tel Aviv and so forth. They were...
Shikari said, what, rather than Israel?
Yeah, there was real fear, and nobody could stop this thing from, you know, there was a period of tension for about 2 weeks leading up to it. And every day you're hearing the news, you know, it's getting, you know, of course, the diplomats were trying to, everything was, every diplomatic venture, yeah, they pulled the UN troops out, and it just seemed that there was a collision course. And then It just broke out on a Monday morning, and that evening, on the news that evening, I remember them saying it appears that Israel has scored a first round knockout contest. But then, these surprise airstrikes, you read about it. It's true, they actually, they managed to win it on the first day, because that's the story of the history of the war, right? It seemed that the experience in the final was necessary on two levels. One is to create the physical foundation of a nation. That takes place in the front. And because there's many components to a nation. It's not even that only God knows what it takes. There's no one that really can understand how you can develop a nation. These things, most nations are developed, because of other factors. This is a different kind of a nation. That's a whole story in and of itself. So that's what the Haggadah does speak about, that God passed over them and saw them, that they had been fully formed. It does talk about that in the Haggadah. It compares it to a woman, you had been formed and so on and so forth, but you were lacking in, mitzvahs. That's what the Haggadah says later on. That's to explain why God gave them the two mitzvahs. The ever I liar. And I saw that you were beautiful and formed and so forth, which means to say that all the components of nationhood were in place, but they were lacking the key element, which was mitzvah. Aside from that, though, is the factor of the enslavement. And the enslavement was essential to produce that state of mind where they'd be searching, a philosophical nation. Take a group of people and create them into thinkers, people who would abandon the natural course of the instincts and the emotions, which pursue, which believe that happiness lies in success and pleasures and so forth. And to get them into the framework of really searching for truth and recognition that for man, the only thing that's going to give them ultimate happiness is going to be in the area of knowledge and truth. That was necessary. For that, the slave experience was necessary. So those are the two, I'd say the two main factors. That was essential for the formation of Klal Yisrael, the experience. That's why God revealed it to Abraham, that he was telling him that he had the plan. He was revealing information. That was Abraham's desire to perpetuate. His concern was, I've discovered this whole system, this body of ideas, which is essential for man's existence. Otherwise, he has no purpose. And once I go, and what, I have a couple of people, my followers, they'll never survive. How can they survive? So how will these ideas be maintained throughout history? So then God revealed the plan. I have a plan. And you're instrumental in this plan. You're part of this nation that I'm going to establish, and this nation will be established in such a way that it'll exist throughout history, and it'll be the source for the truth to be able to maintain itself throughout history. And part of that plan, you reveal part of how it's going to come about. Part of that does entail the development of a nation, and the development of a nation, in order to do so, you'll have to have this slave experience. What was needed was the people that was able to remove themselves from that complete attachment to the instinctual, the primitive instinctual idolatry, and to attach themselves to a system of ideas, a system of mitzvahs which is based on concepts. That's expressed in the whole mitzvah of Korban Pesach. And the thing that bothers everybody in the Torah, and you see this even from the nations which have accepted theoretically that the Torah is true, but they only accept the Torah after they remove the mitzvahs. The whole lesson of Christianity, what's the New Testament? They can't negate the old, so-called Old Testament, right? But the mitzvahs don't apply. They can't accept the mitzvahs. And the same thing with the Muslims. They can't. Why don't they? If they accept that it's true, so why don't they keep the mitzvahs? So then they make up this whole myth that mitzvahs are not necessary then, because people want to know about it, and so forth. But you see, that the natural disposition of man is to reject the mitzvahs. And that's what Chazal is saying, that every other nation that God approached rejected it because of the mitzvahs. Because that conflicts with the person. The person believes that he cannot exist unless he has instinctual freedom. And that's what a person is longing for. And when people get drunk, and people go on binges, and people, all the fantasies of a person, he's going to leave it all behind him. What does it mean? to be in this state of instinctual freedom. That's what he really believes in the ultimate. It's like people envy children. They look at their children like a child. The notion that my problems would be over if I could have that state of, that's what people want. Well, sure, they believe that in that situation I can now indulge all of my desires. Now if you would study the matter, you'd see how false it is. But people don't study the matter. It's a very overwhelming emotion. And that's what they're very searching for. Now that does not, the system of Torah, which means you have to be subservient to discipline, objective limitations on your instincts, and to redirect your energy into different channels, that's not appealing to a person. It does not, appear to a person to be a pleasurable thing. To create a people, to create a nation is one thing, but to create a nation that would be willing to accept, and if they weren't willing to accept the Torah, so then what good is it? They wouldn't have any kiyum. You have to have a Kabbalah Satorah. And in spite of that, there's the indication of the first Kabbalah, the first acceptance was that of fear. It doesn't mean live fear of being killed, I mean, that's the way it's presented. But it means that it was resistance. Clearly, you see, well, the way we explained it was that it was, they were, on an emotional level, there was resistance. But they had no choice. They had no choice because they were at least able to recognize that this must be true, even though it seems to me like painful medicine. But that was the experience of being slaves in Egypt was essential to produce that type of mentality that would be willing to accept the Torah. By the way, that's why, lest you're making a good point, lest you feel superior, the Torah always says, the Vizacharta ki avadim, you should always remember that you were slaves in the land of Egypt. That's why the Torah keeps admonishing us that we should be considerate to the Ge'er. We can't oppress the Ge'er. Why can Ge'er and be some Ge'er at the time? We should never lose that idea that we should never feel that we're an inherently superior people. We're not inherently superior. We're no different than anybody else, but it's because of God's relationship to us that we underwent certain experiences, and because of the schus of the Yaros, if it weren't for the Yaros, then we would not have the Torah, because we're not inherently worthy of the Torah. We're just the descendants of the Yaros, so that designated us, that factor, as being the best suited for this task. And even that itself, we had descended to a low level. Were it not for the experiences that we went through of being Avadim, we also would be just like everybody else. So never look down upon the other person because you know it's different than him. If you begin to feel that you're different, that you're superior, so then you're in bad shape. You're in bad, then you're in trouble. Why this Pesach of all the holidays? Pesach is one of the most popular holidays. It's more everybody. Chanukah is one of them, but the Pesach is one on a sociological level. It's probably the most popular. Everybody observes a Seder. Now there's many reasons for it. Of course, it's family. Yeah, you know, it has a little bit of like ceremonial elements. And Judaism in general doesn't,
like home rather than.
Yeah, it's in the home and there's food. But aside from that, there's another thing that's very appealing. Even to like the people, Jews that are sophisticated liberals and they don't identify at all with the philosophy of it's because of freedom. The idea of freedom. Now it's amazing, the idea of freedom that they're attaching themselves to is not the idea of freedom of the Haggadah.
It's in total contrast.
The idea of the Haggadah is, of freedom is to be an Eved, to be an Eved of Hashem. See? And what they imagine is freedom, the Torah would regard as being enslavement. They're enslaved to their own instinct. They're just living a life of instinctual gratification. But the Haggadah says that the Higiyanu, that God took us out of all these miracles, the Higiyanu, and La Laila Hazeh, to this night, Lechol Bo Matzah Mara, to eat Matzah Mara, which means that the entire purpose of everything was so that we should be servants of God doing mitzvahs, fulfilling the command. That is the real freedom. The real freedom is when we are in line with the will of God. And they would regard what the real freedom of the Seder is, they would regard as basically enslavement. They rejected that. Yet they love the Seder because it's freedom. But that's not the freedom, it's a total distortion. This shot, Anochi Alpha Gamolo, I will bring you up from there, is not a reference to Yaakov himself. It's a reference to the Jewish people. Which I think is a brilliant deduction by the Rav. That from that, that when he's telling you not fear to go down, Altira Merdah, Radah, raid, to go down to Egypt, is telling him that you're not visiting Yosef. You're going down to Egypt. This is going to be, this is going to be the next phase. It's not permanent. In other words, that's what they're going to tell. Don't think that Yaakov decided that he wanted to become an Egyptian. He went there to sojourn, but it is a sojourn. That is the next phase. It's the next phase in the development of the people. But I said that's what God is telling me. Because otherwise it doesn't make any sense. What's he afraid of? He went voluntarily. And the thing that he's telling him not to be afraid of, it doesn't make sense, because he's saying, I'm going to go down with you, I'm going to take you out. He never takes him. God doesn't take Yaakov out either. Yaakov dies in Egypt. So he's never taken out. I mean, taken out to be buried is certainly not what he was afraid of. So clearly he's referring to him in the framework of Klal Yisrael. Vayomer Elokim LeYisrael v'amarot halayla.
He's called from Yaakov.
That's true, but Yisrael. He's referred to as Israel. Israel is the nation. Now then the person to whom this message is addressed is Yaakov, but it's in the framework of Yisrael. That is, it's a referring to the nation. And if that's the case, then this dream does contain the command to go down there and just stay there. And that would explain where, you know, why they made such a decision, why they didn't plan to return to Canaan. Onus al pi ha-dibur, that's what the Haggadah is saying. That they were coerced by the dibur, the command of God. Where was the command of God? From this dream, do not be afraid. Go down there, I'll remove you. Everything was communicated to him through the word of God. That's a brilliant term, talking about how to, can a person look at his own deeds objectively. The ability to look at your own deeds objectively is important, not just in the area of action, but directing your actions. It's important in the area of learning as well. When a person, what's the purpose of a chavrusa? What do you mean? What do you learn by chavrusa? Usually, I'm not talking about on the level of fundamental beginner where you can't work out the Gemara together. But assuming you can learn on your own, it's still good to learn the chavrusa. Why? What's the purpose of the chavrusa? Is to test out your ideas. So you say your idea, then the other person listens. He listens to your idea objectively, and he tries to break it down. He finds all the different flaws that there might be in all the questions, and then you're forced to confront them. So either you'll improve, you'll expand and improve the svara, or you'll have to recognize that it's wrong. And then now he gives his svara, and you do the same thing. You act in the same way, you're critical. So you do have the capacity to be critical about ideas and to be objective about ideas. The only thing is, that's true when it's the other person's ideas. Then you become extremely good at being critical. However, when it's your own ideas, then you act in a different kind of a way. You're not as critical anymore. And you see, there's a big difference. I've seen it many, many times that the person, a person will, one of the guys will play his part, and another guy will take it apart beautifully, logically, show every flaw in perfect analysis. Yeah, then he himself will say his part, which is subject to just as weak and subject to just as much criticism, and yet when he loves his part and he doesn't notice any of the problems. So what's going on here? So you see there's a subjective factor in ideas as well. Now, is it possible for a person to overcome the subjective element? When it's your idea, then you look at it differently. Since you are attached to this idea, your ego is attached to this idea, it's yours, so now you're not going to be as critical about it. When it's somebody else's idea, it's not yours, so now you have the capacity of analysis, you're objective, so you look at it purely objectively. You may not be, out to knock it down, you may not be out to knock it down, but you certainly have the capacity to be objective about it. Now, so what should a person do? In terms of development, the method that I suggested, I mean, I came up with this idea, I think it works. I think you can do it. Is that when you know, when you're working on a svara, you work on a svara, okay, and you know, whatever work it takes, and when you finally come up with a product, you come up with something which makes sense to you, you think you have the idea, you have an answer. So now the immediate thing is to tell it over to somebody. Forget about something else. Switch roles. I think you can do this. It is playing games, but it's a game that works. Now imagine that this was not yours, that you were sitting in a classroom and somebody else said the idea to you. If you were hearing the idea, well, how would you respond to it? Now, I mean, it may take a little bit of training. At first, you're not going to be as critical because, of course, you know that it's really yours. But if you train yourself, you force yourself, like take a pad, whatever it is, write down the idea, and then look through every weak link in the idea, what will happen is you'll begin to relate to this as it's not yours anymore. It's just an idea. You've separated yourself from the idea. So now you're learning to be objective about your own ideas. That's a fantastic development. That will help you in every area of your life. Because you have ideas in everything. In business, you have ideas in relationships, you have ideas in family. You have that same problem. That's why people are very good. A lot of people are great advisors to others. They give great, great advice. They're very smart. But when it comes to their own situations, they're not, because of that subjective factor. They haven't trained, they've learned the art of objectivity. Well, that's one level, because there are certain people that can't be objective at all. That's one level. But they only can apply it to areas that aren't attached to their own ego. They can't be objective about themselves. Now, learning helps you to become objective about yourself in a very significant area, your own ideas. Now, that's true if you can be objective about your own ideas, theoretical ideas in learning, then you can become objective about your ideas in all areas. And you can be objective, you can learn how to be objective about your own behavior. Because you could always employ that same device. Review the behavior, and now imagine if you were the observer. Put yourself, and somebody else came in and acted that way. That wasn't you. How would you react to that? And then seek to attack it and analyze it from every angle. So now you're taking that same, what you must do, there's two steps over here. You have to disassociate this from you, from yourself, and then look at it as though it came from somebody else. How would you analyze it then? And then see, when you bring in those yeah buts, they're all subjective. See? Learn how to distinguish. If that's the case, it is possible. In my opinion, it is possible for a person to develop the habit of objectivity, of course, within limits. Obviously, there is a subjective element. That's why we do have advisors. That's why we do have teachers. We do have friends and so forth. Because we recognize in very important decisions, you want to, you know, there's always that danger of the subjective factor. But you can reduce it to a tremendous extent. In the early stages, though, the more when you try to do this, you will see. Usually, when you start out, the ego is more attached to getting an answer. That's what you want. You want an answer. There's more emotional desire for an answer than for a breakdown. I mean, a breakdown leaves you with nothing. Well, of course, when you're beyond this type of thing, you're really involved in the love of the learning itself. So then, you enjoy a good breakdown. You enjoy the process. Involved in the process. That comes a little bit later. I think in the opening phases, you really love an answer. And you love the fact that it's your answer. You gave the answer. Let's face it, that's the emotion. So you have to contend against that because the breakdown means you're losing something. Something you want. And the same thing is true when you have to be objective about a plan. You're planning, you know, let's say you're thinking about getting married or a girl or a house. Whatever is something that you want. And now you're going to try and be objective and think critically about it. Well, yeah, but the emotion is stacked up on the other side. You know, what the answer that you want, you know what answer you want as a result of the analysis. So maybe you're just going through the emotions to come up with the answer that you already want. So it's, in the opening phases, it's going to be more difficult. I don't think it's equal energy. With a chavrusa, it's another force that's not at all committed to the answer. If anything, you might say, he's committed to Benjamin. Right? So you have to build up that force within you, which is critical. And you have to work hard. You develop a certain discipline. And you don't allow yourself to be fooled. Even if Kavrusa is not necessarily one who has animosity towards you. It's not necessarily one. Because if it's that the case, you're going to waste a lot of time and energy. The smart can be good, you can advance to the point, but he's just going to keep coming at all crazy angles for no reason. I mean, everything has to be done, you know, with moderation, with the proper limit, even breaking something down. I mean, you can go on ad infinitum and you can't get anywhere. So even there, I don't know if that's the case. But I think that in the early phases, you will not have as much energy in the breakdown. But after, this is training. I mean, this is something you develop as a habit. And you subject your own ideas to the objective approach. You actually imagine as though somebody else had said it. Somebody had presented it to you. And you were going to analyze it. What would you say? Then it'll help you because, see, then you really don't need a chavrusa that much. I mean, because then you can really perfect your own ideas. Then it turns out that you've noticed three problems. It doesn't mean the idea is no good. Then you'll go back to being you, whoever the you is over there. Yeah. Then you'll, I've heard those questions. It's like switching roles. Okay, so now you didn't notice that before. Do I have to abandon the theory, or can I accommodate, can I modify? Oh, so you make a modification. Now you go back to, okay, now this is the theory. Anything wrong with this theory? And you play both roles. You can do that. It's very possible to do that. So you treat your own idea as though it emanated from a different source. And then you're in a totally different plane. In terms of development of thinking, the analytical ability comes quicker and is much easier to develop. In other words, there are two steps in the learning process. The ability to analyze something, logical analysis. A person can be brilliant in logical analysis, but that doesn't mean that he can come up with the idea, the spark. That's creativity. To come up with an idea, to create an idea, a theory that covers the facts, that's a totally different part of the mind. It's a different process. I don't mean different part of the mind, that's a different process. You understand that? Now, it is easier, with the proper training, anybody can be trained to think logically. Okay? Anybody can be trained to think logically and analytically, and learn the analysis is a method, there's a method. The person is willing to make the effort, assuming he has a normal human brain, it's programmed into the human brain to think logically, analytically. Even you see in the secular world, of all the different disciplines, the ones that are the best at this, doesn't mean that they're objective in general, like lawyers. In their area, they're very good at breaking. They're not creative thinkers. They're very creative about their strategies, you know, how to work out alternative explanations. Alternative explanations, you know, how to distort reality. But that training, because there you're forced, the essence of legal training essentially is to be able to logically analyze all the information, the facts, very carefully, and the connections. That's part of your training. You know, somebody's like a statement, right? And someone is making a statement. You're going to try and break them down. To do so, you must logically analyze it if everything fits. Now that area, that method of logical analysis, you know, the Gemara is the best training ground for that. That I think is easier. So that comes first. That comes first. And usually when you're a student, you find yourself in the position of criticizing other people's ideas, because it's the Rebbe that gives the idea, and you're trying to analyze it, to break it down. Of course, at the same time, from an emotional standpoint, what you're really attracted to is to coming up with the answer. From an intellectual standpoint, that's what you want. You want the knowledge, then you want the answer. And emotionally, of course, that's where the ego is attached. That is a more advanced, more difficult step. And it's not that is something which you, I don't think there's any specific method to give it over to you. That is something where you have to be cultivated, but it's a different type of a process. One can cultivate that, but that's creativity. So a lot depends upon how you relate to the cultivation. See? It's a different type of thing. It's not like a mathematical thing. I can teach you step one, step two, step three, and step four. See? Analytics, logical analysis, there's a method. I can teach you. You can pick it up. I can guarantee that you'll be able to do it. The Svara is something else. It's a certain amount of artistry, creativity, you know, intuition, and logical, of course, logical thinking. It's not that... A lot of fellows go wrong if they try and use a mechanical approach. They try and, you know, they get the terms, that's the garbage, this, that, and they try to use like a computerized mechanical approach. It just doesn't work. Because you got it doesn't lend itself to that. The theory is a different type of a thing. He says if he's in that state where his limbs are shaking and he feels this tremendous enthusiasm, Mistama he may atasiate Tara. He says that most probably this is coming from the council of the evil inclination. Kiech yuchal lios, for how can it be, evari hadguf hakvedim, that the limbs of the heavy limbs of the body, Hashem e'ofer yisodam, that come from dust, the tivam leilach achar tavasam, and their teva, their nature, is to follow their instincts, hagufoni, their physical instincts. Yislapshu Ratzon, how is it possible that they will become, you know, take on the cloak of a desire, they will take on a desire, lasos, to do the mitzvah. Einzeh ki imatzas yetzahara. This is nothing but the advice, the counsel of the evil inclination. In order that he should be trapped afterwards in its net. The imbitashukas nafsha rapamimius, but if this were to come from the desire of his innermost soul, liskariv eloseil, to draw closer to his creator, with masa hamisos, in other words, what would be the reaction if this were stemming from some other components within his personality? From his the desire of his soul to become closer to the Creator. He's saying if that were the case, then the wounds of his body would be heavy, vat salem, and lazy. There'd be resistance. That would be the natural... That would be because that would be in line with their own nature. And now he goes on and mentions another point. So the thing is like this. I would say, just like this. Vatera ki misameta si lalechas. He goes back to the pasuk now. It's a beautiful explanation of the pasuk. Fits in with the word. Because she was trying to convince her not to go. To go back, turn back, Rus. And then the pasuk says, at what point did she stop? When she saw that she was determined. She was like forcing herself. She was forcing herself, right, to go. So he reads it like this. Also here, Eini Yechola Lele Chachara. It turns out Rus was not able to go out, to follow her anymore. Even though she was much younger than her. Ruth was young, you know, Naomi was an older woman. Bilti amitz v'guf. She couldn't follow anymore unless she... That's the implication. The implication is she had to force herself. It's an implication of the word. That's not the simple translation. Again, that's not the simple translation, but there's a certain nuance and implication. That this is unnatural because she's younger, and she should be... Physically, she was stronger, but she had to... She had now to force herself to go. Via Giyarabba, she had to work very hard to just go. So then she ceased dissuading her. Limnoa osam ea mitzvos. Then she stopped dissuading her from the mitzvos. Ki hakavana mitzara tovu. Because she saw that the intention was, in other words, that's the implication in the pasuk. The implication in the pasuk was, that she had to strengthen herself. That she wasn't running after her with this natural. That is the point at which Naomi saw that she was sincere. That it wasn't with this fervor, this superficial zeal and fervor and enthusiasm. But she was really forcing herself. Now, if that's the case, that shows that it really stems from the innermost desire to do the good. That's an interesting idea. You see, it's very interesting because today it's just the opposite. That everybody says just the opposite. That when a person's in that state of, they encourage that, to be in that state of zeal, you know, that religious fervor, the state of fervor, is really regarded as a very good thing. According to this, you have to be extremely suspicious of it. When a person, what is preferable? Oh yeah, well certainly it's preferable in terms of perfection to do the mitzvot out of the incentive, out of the Yetzirah Tov. That's clearly the case. But he's not saying that it's evil. We're not saying that it's evil. But what is very important though is that a person should be able to recognize his motives and not to mistake a emotion of fervor. That's very dangerous. If a person mistakes an emotion of fervor, which is stemming from the instinctual, if he mistakes that for which most people do, I believe there's a lot of that going on. That's why, for example, this case you mentioned, I mean, you know, these instantaneous conversions, you know, so to speak. I mean, even amongst Jews, it's called Baal Tshuva. Where you find that happening, where, for the last 20, 25 years, the person is living a complete instinctual lifestyle. All of his desires, lust, and so forth. And suddenly, overnight, he finds religion, and he's jumping and screaming, you know, like he loves to daven, he loves this, he loves that. That's not the way it works. I'm not saying it's a bad thing, because the person is closer. The person is closer to the truth, but to mistake that as being that emotion that he feels as being a sign of perfection, that religious fervor that he feels, that's contrary to what the Vilna Gaon is saying. That fervor is obviously stemming from something else, because it's an impossibility. It's an impossibility, and we'll put it in our terms, that a person whose energy is all directed towards the instinctual, that would produce a state of conflict. That's what he means. So naturally a person should be in a state of conflict. And you see, there is a concept of reason like being in the mitzvah. There is a concept where a person does feel, there's two types, he's not talking about that here. There are two types of religious zeal. There is a zeal which stems from the Yetzirah Tov, from the good inclination. We're talking about, the context over here is like someone like Naomi, a beginner. It would seem to me almost impossible for a beginner to feel. I'm sorry? Rus, we're talking about Rus, you're right. To start out with, what he seems to be saying is that that a person is in a state of conflict, that there is a component within him which senses the good and has desire for the good, but until he reaches a certain level, the result of that would result in putting him in a state of conflict. His body isn't going along with it. That's the way man is constructed by nature. Now, he says when he's in that state, his body is not going along with it, yet he still wants to do it, that's good. That shows that it's pure. Because if it were not pure, if it were impure, that would mean that it would be stemming from deriving energy, right? From the Yetzer Hara, then he would not be, that would be eliminated. What's eliminating the resistance? What's causing the body to want to go along with this? Oh, according to him, it's not the desire to do the good. The body has no desire to do the good. The emotions have no desire to do the good. So therefore, it has to be that what's producing the emotion is that it's become aligned with the mitzvah. Somehow the emotion is being gratified. So that zeal is an emotional zeal. A person should be aware of that. That doesn't mean to say that he shouldn't do the mitzvah. I think what Moshe is saying is very good. The important thing is to be aware of it and to identify it correctly, not to be misled by it. Because if a person, that can kill a person. When a person is misled, false idealism can be, that's the most dangerous force. And a person, because in his own mind, all of his energy is now tied in with a false ideal, and there's nothing to stop him anymore. There's nothing to stop him, yeah, because he thinks he's doing the right thing. Nobody said it's a bad thing. I'm just quoting from the Vilna Gaon. All he said is, if you want to distinguish, and apparently he's saying, if you will, it's important to distinguish whether it's coming from the Yetzer Tov or the Yetzer Ra. So it is important to distinguish. Here's a litmus test, so to speak. Okay, that's all I'm saying. He didn't say that. That's why it's a beautiful interpretation. It's a very beautiful interpretation of the pasuk. You see, because it fits in with the words. The nuance is beautiful. That there was a certain reluctance, that she had to strengthen herself to overcome a certain natural resistance. So when Naomi saw that, she said, that's a genuine, this person is genuine. I mean, you see, for example, the idea of zeal, of using a zeal to motivate people, a fervor, to induce that type of a thing, can be a very dangerous thing because it can lead to serious distortion. So, now many people look at it superficially and they say, well, this person is now, you know, let's say you use this messianic type of thing, but to convince people that if they do mitzvot and everything, Mashiach is coming and all that, they produce all these emotions. Now these emotions clearly are not rooted in the proper desire to serve God. They're evoking a certain fantasy in people. So that's the Yetzer Hara. But in order to satisfy that fantasy, so you have to now put on film every day and do, you know, all these different things. But you're not doing it for the true reason. Now that is a example of what we're talking about, fervor and zeal, inducing a feeling of fervor and zeal. And in the person's mind, he really thinks that suddenly he's found God. But it's not. Because the idea of God in his mind can be associated with so many fantasies. So it's a very dangerous kind of a game.
Well, how does one know his own mind?
Ah, well, that's exactly what he says. That's exactly what he's trying to tell you. He said, he gave you one case. If you are in a state of conflict, if you want to do it, but your limbs are not jumping to do it, but still in all, there is something within you that's impelling you to do it, then that's a sign that it's coming from that's a better situation. You see, in other words, what he's saying is, don't forget, you have to realize also, I think there's two types of individual. This is the type of individual at the outset. But the Rambam does talk about someone who serves God out of love, and that seems to be completely the opposite. All of his emotions are propelling him. So that we'll discuss tomorrow. The concept, how does this idea, if this is true, what about everything we've learned about those who serve God out of love and they get tremendous enjoy? According to this, the Vilna Gaon mean that we're always in a state of conflict, you know, like we're always pulled in two different directions? Okay, that I'll leave for tomorrow.